Good evening, and welcome to the World Affairs Council of Northern California. Tonight we are pleased to have with us Mr. Roger Thoreau, distinguished author and foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. I am Michael Dimmock, president of Roots of Change, and I'm honored to be your moderator this evening. I would like to acknowledge Green Apple Books, who is sponsoring tonight's program. The World Affairs Council of Northern California invites you to join us in seeking knowledge, expanding your networks, and discovering innovative solutions to global problems. More information about the organization can be found on our website at itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming audio online. Council programs can also be heard on our weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Today's program is being recorded for It's Your World, and we thank our audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Please take note of the blue question cards on your seats. I would encourage you to write questions legibly for our speaker, and council staff will come by to collect them. It would also be greatly appreciated if you could turn off all cell phones and anything else that might disturb the program. Finally, let me announce a program that might be of interest to you. This Thursday, August 13th, join the council in welcoming Matt Flannery, co-founder and CEO of Kiva, and Keith Taylor, founder and CEO of Modest Needs Foundation, for a discussion on how we can help individuals pull themselves out of the cycle of poverty through innovative online giving markets. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Roger Thoreau is a longtime foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. In his 27 years with the Journal, he has reported from more than 60 countries, including 24 in Africa. He has written on a number of subjects ranging from race relations in the U.S. to hunger and food security in Africa. Along with fellow Wall Street Journal correspondent Scott Kilman, Mr. Thoreau has produced a stream of front-page stories in the Journal that have broken new ground in our understanding of famine and food aid. Three such stories were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting. In 2005, Mr. Thoreau and Mr. Kilman were also honored by the United Nations for their reporting on humanitarian and development issues. Here to discuss geopolitics, aid, and famine, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mr. Roger Thoreau. Thank you.
Avoid the bright light that'll leave me seeing spots or something before the evening. Thank you very much, Michael. And thanks to the council for having me here and for the invitation and the honor to speak with you guys tonight. And thanks, I don't know if Michael's responsible for this or the council or whoever. Thanks for the delightful, wonderful, sunny weather that has greeted me. That was Michael. Over the last the couple of days. I mean, who would have thought that I'd have to leave Chicago in August and come to San Francisco for a suntan, but this is indeed what I've had, and because it's such a nice evening, thanks everybody for coming here tonight, because, as I understand, such evenings in August in San Francisco are something special. So thanks for coming here and sitting indoors. Hopefully we'll take you on a bit of a journey to the other side of the world, and we'll get to some of those slides later of Ethiopia. And thanks for the opportunity to be able to discuss the issue of world hunger and the forces behind famine. And this topic and this gathering tonight is particularly timely because quite a number of people in the Obama administration in Congress and in the humanitarian world, in the halls, in the world beyond the halls of power, are really beginning to dive deeply into the issue of hunger food security, and ending famine, and boosting agriculture production around the world, and particularly in the developing world, and especially in Africa. And it's become, you know, in our reporting, we found it's become a foreign policy priority of the Obama administration. It's something even just these first couple of weeks into their administration that they're already thinking of as a legacy issue, to be the president, to be the Secretary of State, to be the administration that ends hunger. And the president himself has spoken early and often. Early and often is a Chicago phrase that's usually applied to our voting habits. But the president has spoken early and often about hunger and boosting agriculture production around the world, and especially in Africa. I don't know if you all remember, but just minutes after taking the oath of office, he said this in his inaugural address: "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds." Farms flourish, nourish starved bodies. So already he's thinking about it. There wasn't much that he said in the campaign about that, but certainly right away afterwards and right at the start of his administration, he's starting to talk about that. He spoke about it again in London in April at the G20 meeting, where he pledged to double America's spending on agriculture development aid, again, particularly to Africa. And in June, just 6 weeks or so ago, at the G8 meeting in Italy, he convinced his fellow leaders to commit, I think it's $20 billion over 3 years for agriculture development. And if that actually happens, it will reverse decades, the last 30, 40 years of negligence by the rich world, and negligence of the world's poorest people, who are the peasant farmers of the developing world. Then the president went to Ghana, saying that that the United States wanted to be partners with Africa in achieving this boost of food production and the end of hunger. And so now it's basically a matter of living up to those promises. There's a couple of bills in Congress that are moving through both the House and the Senate seeking the funding for all of this. That's always important, and one area of skepticism that, you know, is the rhetoric actually matched, one by the funding and two by the action. Secretary of State Clinton has been in Africa. I don't know if her Africa trip is over yet, but I think she visited seven nations. One thing she was talking about there on almost every stop was the hunger issue and food production, and also seeking the partnership of the African leaders that she spoke to. And it's also become an administration-wide push. It's not only out of the White House, it's the USDA, the Treasury Department, the U.S. Trade Representative, and it's all being coordinated by the National Security Council. And kind of when we heard that, we figured National Security Council, why would they be coordinating this? But they called it the Global Food Security Initiative, and they're looking at it as in terms of food security and redirecting foreign development aid towards the agriculture sector, towards food production, towards ending hunger, and making development aid, or reinstalling development aid alongside diplomacy and defense as the pillars of foreign policy. And so that's where the notion of food security comes from, because their calculation is that it's certainly in our interest in the United States and in Western Europe and in the rich part of the world, and for the world to produce more food and to have fewer hungry nations, and fewer hungry nations would mean fewer unstable nations. Because if you just remember what happened last year, about this time, or about the time before the economic collapse and the financial meltdown, the rioting and turmoil that was in dozens of countries around the world that followed a huge jump in food prices back then. So there's a huge interest and a tremendous interest in government circles in reducing hunger and boosting food aid, and as I said, also among the humanitarian agencies and advocacy groups who are driving this kind of rising momentum and this new movement and grassroots movement to get on top of the hunger issue. Now, little do we know, back in 2007 when we set out to write our book, and even back in 2002, 2003 with the reporting that we were doing that Michael talked about, and Carrie Dolan, one of the great writers and editors of the Wall Street Journal, she edited a number of those stories, so She slouched in her chair, but thanks to Carrie, reporters always need editors standing behind them in this, and she was one in New York who kept asking, well, what's next on this front? Little concern, we went to Zimbabwe at the time, but we persevered and went anyway. But kind of little did we know it that our book would kind of arrive at this very fortuitous and crucial time. Because what we're trying to do in the book is provide a roadmap for where the administration and where the world's leaders and statesmen are looking ahead on this issue. But we also want to provide kind of a rearview mirror so they're able to look backwards and recognize the problems and mistakes that we made in our policies in the United States and in Europe that has just accelerated the hunger problem in Africa and the rest of the developing world. Because we need to heed our mistakes of the past as we move forward looking for solutions to the future. And our book, as you can see, and I will hold on, in a great advertising plug, Enough is the name of our book. Why the world's poor are starving in an age of plenty. Enough. Why enough? In this one word, we've got three meanings. One, there's enough food in the world to feed everyone, and there has been for decades. And that means enough food for everybody to have their nutritional requirements to live an active and meaningful life. Second, enough is enough. We brought hunger with us into the 21st century. 25,000 people still die every day of hunger, malnutrition, and related diseases. That's the equivalent of 60 jumbo jets fully loaded crashing every day. 25,000 people a day dying of hunger, malnutrition, and related diseases. The toll, that toll includes 6 million children annually. So shame on us that we brought hunger with us into the 21st century. Because the Green Revolution was one of the great wonders of the 20th century. It was one of the great technological and scientific achievements of the 20th century. Yet hunger today, 9 years into the 21st century, is growing worse. The UN Food and Agriculture Administration, and also the US Department of Agriculture, the folks who kind of count these things, they've announced that the number of hungry is soaring past 1 billion people this year. That's the highest number since the time of the Green Revolution, since before the Green Revolution. And even more damning is this. The prevalence of hunger is increasing. So the percentage of the population that is hungry is increasing. This year, it'll be 15% of the world's population that's hungry. That's up from 13% just a few years ago. So we're even losing the battle. What the great advantage of the Green Revolution was agriculture production keeping ahead of population increase. Now we've fallen behind that. So enough is enough. Three, there's enough people that are joining the movement and involved in the movement to end hunger. And by all of you coming here tonight and your curiosity and your interest, obviously, in this issue, you're all very part of that movement. And it's a movement that's building across ideologies, across politics, across faith, across class, and across borders. It's a global movement and momentum that's going on, and it's a movement that's waiting to be led. So if the administration is serious about this and continues to press on this, and if everybody from the grassroots level is involved that continues to press them, it's a movement that's willing and eager to be led. And our purpose in writing the book was to help stir this constituency of people, to kind of build on this new momentum that we were seeing out there, and also to reverse the neglect of agriculture development and the resulting hunger that we've seen over the past 3 or 4 decades. And what we wanted to do when we set out was to show how the chronic hunger of today, the chronic hunger, the everyday grind of people going to bed hungry night after night after night, how that's largely a man-made phenomenon and a man-made catastrophe. Certainly there's natural disasters that still happen that cause famine and cause the emergency bursts of hunger. There's drought, and that happens all too frequently and ever more frequently in Africa with the onset of climate change. And there's things like tsunamis, and we saw that in Asia a couple of years ago, where that would wipe out great rice-producing areas and trigger famine in its wake. And, of course, hunger follows corruption and war, things that are also all too frequent in Africa in particular. But so much of today's action is caused by bad policy that spans the political spectrum, and that is eminently avoidable. It's neglect, hypocrisy, ignorance, good intentions gone bad. It's food aid policy. It's our farm subsidies. It's ethanol incentives. It's the self-interest of Western countries and Western governments, again, in the United States, but also in Western Europe. And so our mantra in writing the book was outrage and inspire. So every day, many times during the day, Scott and I would kind of mumble to ourselves, kind of outrage and inspire, outrage and inspire. This is what we wanted to do. Outrage, as I said, that we brought hunger with us into the 21st century and in ever-increasing numbers. And inspire that hunger is one of the problems of the world today that can be conquered. And this is the generation that can do it. And I guess our outrage began stirring after September 11th in 2001. And if you remember, kind of a week or so later, President Bush addressed a nation, and he asked a question that he believed was on the minds of many Americans, and rightly was on the minds of many Americans: why do they hate us? It was a good question. And you can kind of see in his policy response, or in the policies that they followed afterwards, kind of his response to that question. In November of that year, the U.S. pushed for the launch of the Doha round of the World Trade Talks that were dubbed the development round, to bring the developing countries more into the world trade system and thereby hopefully to reduce their poverty. And then in early 2002, there was the Monterey Donors Conference to increase development aid to the developing world and also help them relieve poverty. But then, in May of 2002, President Bush signed the Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill increased subsidies to U.S. farmers, which distorted the global agricultural trade system that they were trying to straighten out and do for the benefit of the developing world in the so-called development round in Doha. And it distorted the global agricultural trade, the subsidies did, to the disadvantage of farmers in the developing world, and particularly the farmers in Africa, who receive no subsidies from their governments. Not only they are too poor to give subsidies, but the international community, led by the World Bank and its major funder, the United States, has ordered African governments out of the agricultural sector, out of support of their farmers, and out of the subsidies business. Flying in the face of all the practices that we hear ourselves do with support of the farmers, and for historical reasons that we go into in the book. Again, well-intentioned policies gone bad, and the hypocrisy that rises from that. So where was the anger coming from? The Farm Bill was one of the answers. And so in our reporting for the Wall Street Journal, that's just one thing that Scott and I then began focusing on: our agricultural policies, and particularly the impact of the Farm Bill. And we began asking a question: why can't Africa feed itself? What happened to Africa? Why did the Green Revolution never get to Africa? We came across this quote from Norman Borlaug, who was the father of the Green Revolution and a humble plant scientist from a tiny town in Iowa. Norman Borlaug won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 for his work on the Green Revolution. Is basically credited with being a man who perhaps saved more people than anybody else in history. The day after he won a Nobel Peace Prize, Norman Borlaug gave his Nobel lecture. And this is what he said. They're very haunting words. It was 1970, remember. Man can and must prevent the tragedy of famine in the future. Instead of merely trying with pious regret to salvage the human wreckage of the famine, as he has so often done in the past, we will be guilty of criminal negligence without extenuation if we permit future famines. Criminal negligence. Scott and I saw that, and the light went off. Ah, that's what we were. We're crime reporters. That as we reported more and more about the hunger issue, why can't Africa feed itself, we were investigating one of the great crimes of our age. Why was hunger getting worse as we moved out of the 20th century and as we moved into the 21st century? We continued our reporting, and then came the Ethiopian famine of 2003, which was a watershed for us, for our reporting, I think for the international community in general that is concerned with hunger and agricultural issues, and is basically the center or the core of our book. Because the Ethiopian famine of 2003, if you all think back to the Ethiopian famine of 1984, which is truly epic in proportion, a million people died in the famine of 1984. It was a communist government. They basically said, there is no famine in our country because the communists, whether they're in Ethiopia or Eastern Europe or Cuba, they don't recognize any kind of social problems in their country. There was no hunger. There was no famine in Ethiopia, according to them. At that time, hundreds of thousands of people were dying. And so by the time the BBC and other television networks got up there and the film footage came out, widespread and mass starvation. But in 1984, it was about 10 to 12 million people that were on the doorstep of starvation. So 10 to 12 million in 1984. And that prompted kind of the Live Aid concerts. It prompted, you know, We Are the World, the song we've been hearing over and over since Michael Jackson's death. He was one of the writers of that song. And all sorts of pious pledges of how this should never happen again, the horror, the misery of it all, how this should never happen again. Well, 19 years later, in 2003, it was happening again. And in essence, it was worse. Not in terms of the number of people who died, because the relief agencies were on the ground, the government rang the alarm bells right away, we're in trouble. But in 2003, there were 14 million people that were on the verge of starvation. 10 to 12 million in 2004, 19 years later, in 1984, 19 years later, we're up to 14 million people that are on the verge of starvation. What happened? Kind of therein lies the tale of our book. It kind of, you know, is the tale of I think, what the Obama administration is trying to do. And it was basically Borlaug's criminal neglect come to life, or rather, come to death. So I went to Ethiopia with Terry's encouragement and other editors. And on my first day in Addis Ababa in 2003, I was meeting with the World Food Program, and Voli Karuchi, one of their water experts, kind of took me aside in their grand conference room and kind of sprawled up the map of Africa and said, here's where the famine zones are. And he told me something that's kind of haunted me ever since and has really driven our reporting and our writing. Voli told me, looking into the eyes of someone dying of hunger becomes a disease of the soul. You see that nobody should have to die of hunger. The next day I was off down to the famine zones with Voli, and I was able to look into the eyes of the hungry and the starving. And what I saw was indeed the impact of our policies, the neglect, the hypocrisy, the ignorance, the well-intent, the good intentions gone bad, the policies that we'll see. You know, somebody had said that charity often sees the need and not the cause, but what I saw in the eyes of the starving in Ethiopian then was the cause. So let's go to Ethiopia and look in some of those eyes. This boy is Hargirso Hitema, 5 years old at the time. This is an emergency feeding tent up in the highlands, kind of showing all the classic signs of severe malnutrition with a swollen head, kind of a stick-thin arms and legs. He's 5 years old. He was 27 pounds when his father, Tesfaye, who's sitting behind him, brought him in to the emergency feeding tent. As I said, on the verge of starvation. His father brought him in. And the interesting thing about that, and there's another little child next who's obviously also in horrible condition. His father, they're basically having to be held up between the legs of their parents because otherwise they would fall over. They're so weak. The interesting thing was, the year before, Tesfaye was carrying huge 100-pound sacks of grain, his surplus grain, to this very same market in Bericha, basically just down the road from where the emergency feeding tents are. What had happened in Ethiopia was, in the years of 2000, 2001, 2001, 2002, in the growing and planting seasons, which kind of span the calendar years, Ethiopian farmers in general had the best harvest of their lives. They had bumper crops, because since 1984, the push was on to produce. Let's boost production in Ethiopia and elsewhere in Africa. It worked. They boost production. Norman Borlaug was back working in Africa trying to bring the Green Revolution finally to Africa. It worked. They had all this tremendous production. When they brought what happens in Africa is when the harvests come, they all come onto the market, all the production basically comes onto the market at the same time because they need money to pay back whatever small debts they have. They need money to buy other food, to kind of supplement what they've grown. That's the time that they have money to feed their families, to clothe their families,
maybe put some money aside for their kids to go to school, everything comes to the market at the same time. After two successive years of harvest, of bumper harvest, in 2002, the harvest comes to the market all at the same time. What happens? Prices collapsed. Collapsed catastrophically in Ethiopia, 80% prices collapsed. Tesfaye, who's carrying his big, huge 100-pound bag of grain to the market, he gets there and the price that he's offered is lower than his cost of production. It's lower than his fertilizer cost, it's lower than his seed cost, lower than whatever labor cost he's and transport cost he's calculated. So he loses money on the deal. Larger commercial farmers who have maybe 1,000, 2,000 acres of land, and they're growing wheat and corn the same as they are in Illinois and Iowa. Little different, you know, geographic background, but these guys can grow and they have big farms. Some of the commercial farmers had their best harvest of their lives, and they lost $250,000 because of the price collapse. What'd they do? Their reaction was the same as farmers anywhere else in the world. You lose money, you cut back expenses. Tesfaye, as a peasant farmer, maybe farming one and a half acres, 3/4 acre, he stopped using fertilizer when he planted next year. He, instead of using the hybrid seeds, which are a little bit more expensive, would give him a little bit better yield, he basically used whatever kind of normal seeds that he had in his house. He knew, because of those actions, that his production, his yield, his harvest would go down. But he figured, hey, so I had a surplus crop, what good did that do me? I lost money. I'm going to grow enough to feed my family. This is the calculation of peasant farmers. I'll grow enough to feed my family. The commercial farmers going through the same process did the same things. Fertilizer use in Ethiopia fell 27% that year. The use of hybrid seeds fell over 70%. One of the commercial farmers shut off his irrigation system because he couldn't afford the petrol, the diesel, to run it. They knew they were going to have lesser harvest, but that's okay, as long as they could feed their families. So they all look having worked for rain. Rain didn't come in 2003. If it came, it was much less than they had expected. The rains didn't come. Some of the crops failed. Hunger spread. Hunger tipped into famine. Tesfaye is carrying his 5-year-old son, weighing 27 pounds, to the emergency feeding tent. What happened was the markets failed before the weather did. It was the market failure that they couldn't move their surplus crops. There's no marketing system to move anything. There's no board of trade over there until recently. The farm-to-market roads, the infrastructure was so bad that you couldn't move it from the surplus areas to the deficit areas of the country. You couldn't. The storage is really flimsy. They don't have the big, aluminum and metal grain silos that you see all over the United States. They have like little flimsy, wooden storage bins, if even that. So in the midst of the famine that then resulted, they figured 300,000 tons of grain wasted and rotted in the fields of Ethiopia because there wasn't a marketing system to absorb it. So here we have this cruel paradox. The markets failed before the weather did. In a biblical sense, feast gave way to famine. From the farmer's success came their failure. The lesson, markets matter. And it was the failure of the markets and of the development agencies in the Western countries to help the markets take hold in places like this. The other families in the emergency feeding tent. Oh, what's this photo? This is Germán Amente. He's one of the commercial farmers. He's also a grain trader. This is some of the wheat, corn, beans, lentils, peas that he grew himself and had bought from some of his from his neighbors and the peasant farmers. This is in his warehouse in Ethiopia, in the town of Nazareth, in the middle of the 2003 famine. This is all the grain he was storing up because prices had collapsed so badly. Had he put this grain on the market, it would have collapsed even further. So he had this in his warehouse in Ethiopia in the middle of the famine. He's in the town of Nazareth, which is one of the main trading centers for agriculture goods in Ethiopia. 2 blocks from his warehouse is the main road that runs from the port of Djibouti, where most of the food aid comes into the country, to Addis Ababa, the capital. Over that road, millions of tons of food aid flowed in 2003. Thank heaven for the food aid because it kept many Ethiopians alive, and German would be one of the first to applaud and acknowledge that. But that food aid rushed into the country, most of it American food aid, over 50%. American food aid system requires, it's a mandate, that all American food aid be locally grown. It has to be U.S.-grown food and shipped on American-flagged vessels. So in the midst of the famine, America, horrible famine, so many people dying, what do? Our response, food aid. But it's all American-grown food that goes over. Here's all this Ethiopian grain that's still sitting here. German scrambles to the top of one of his columns of food, and he says, Roger, take my picture. And used to put the caption underneath, please send food to Ethiopia. Ethiopia has no food. Kerry, we didn't have room to run this picture back then. We weren't as graphic as we are now. And so I show this to at least, you know, do good to German, that this picture is being used and seen by people. And so this kind of illustrates the problem of American food aid. Look at this. Same thing. There's another man's warehouse right down. So you'd go out to the parking lot of these guys' warehouses, and you'd hear the rumble of the American food aid trucks and feel it going past. So what they were saying is, thanks for the food. It's great to have it here. But they were writing a letter to their government saying, can you please instruct the donors of American food aid? Gee, it's thanks. It's coming in. This is great. Can you please send cash so you can buy up our food first? Because if this food isn't bought and our warehouses aren't cleared out, one, we have no money to buy the food from the farmers the next year, and two, we have no space to store it, so we're going to be in the same situation as the previous years. When their harvest comes in, there's not going to be any market for it, there's not going to be any storage for it, it's all going to rot, you know, back on the, and farmers will lose their incentive. Again, while I was talking to these guys in Ethiopia and reading their petition to their government, Scott was talking to American farmers, mainly out in the Palouse, in the Northwest. And what they were doing is the wheat farmers, they were also writing a letter to their government in the White House. There was a bumper crop of wheat that year, having the same effect as in Ethiopia. The U.S. bumper crop of wheat was putting pressure on American wheat prices. The American wheat farmers were writing to the American government, hey, it'd be a good idea if you could put more wheat in the U.S. food aid system to help our prices recover. The conclusion of the Ethiopians, when I relayed that to them, to that story to them, was that, American farmers need starving Ethiopians. And it was a difficult thing to argue and refute with them at the time. These are some of my favorite lentil farmers. They're standing out alongside the road from Djibouti. When I got there, after leaving the warehouses, these guys, their lentil fields are out, you know, somewhere behind them. The drought had taken a toll on that. These guys are both also on food aid and surviving from it. You can just tell by the way they're dressed. This is what kind of peasant farmers in Africa look like. A lot of the farmers are women, and these guys happen to be strolling alongside the road. And these guys are interesting, so I'm talking to them, and as I'm talking, a big load of food aid comes driving by in kind of double-wide trucks full of the brim of food and bags. And as it goes by, some of it is, the roads are horribly potholed, so they're bouncing along, and some of the grain falls out on the ground. After the trucks go by, these guys like run out to the road, and I follow them, and they're very curious, well, what is that? And so they pick it up. Again, these guys are lentil farmers. They bend over and they pick it up, and it's lentils. And they're like, why, thank heaven for the food aid, but why are lentils coming to the country? Don't they know that we grow lentils in Ethiopia, and we got a surplus of lentils from the last couple of years that we can't get rid of, and some of theirs, they're worried about, even being wasted. And I said, no, I don't believe that in the United States they know that you guys grow lentils and could perfectly grow lentils to feed the country if you had the assistance to do that. What this shows and what these two guys represent is kind of this very skewed ratio between U.S. development aid and U.S. food aid. So in 2003, the U.S. government sent more than $500 million in food aid to Ethiopia. Yet that very same year, the U.S. government spent less than $5 million on agricultural aid in Ethiopia. $500 million in food aid, less than $5 million in agricultural development aid so they could grow enough food so they wouldn't be in the position of having to need the food aid to begin with. A horribly skewed relationship. These photos are all from the outrage part of our mantra, by the way. Final one. This guy with a turban on his head, scarf rolled into a turban, his name is Tesfahun Belichu, another peasant farmer. Tesfahun means be hope in the Amharic language, be hope. At this stage in 2003, Tesfahun was utterly bereft of hope. The drought, it's funny, things will look green in Ethiopia. It's kind of called the green famine because their shortage of food was precipitating the famine when the rains of the next planting season come, and that food is not yet up and grown for them to harvest to alleviate their hunger and the famine. So what you see, the green in the background, these aren't plants, this is just kind of vegetation, but that there was some growth starting to come up from the next year. But his field was basically parched from the drought. He was on food aid also for a number of months. This is interesting because he is standing beside the Rib River, which is one of the tributaries of the Blue Nile River. The Blue Nile is one of the great waterways of Africa and one of the great waterways of the world. And the Blue Nile basically tumbles through all sorts of series of gorges into Sudan. In Sudan, it runs up, it connects with the White Nile coming from the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. In Khartoum, they meet together and they form the Great Nile, and the Great Nile steams into Egypt and brings the Sahara Desert to light in Egypt. So I asked Tesfahun, yeah, you're standing beside this water. Why don't you tap some of that for irrigation? And he kind of fixes me with this look. And as if to say, you know, we're not stupid. And he says, of course we thought about that. But when we don't have enough money to basically develop a sustainable system, you know, we can do it, take some out. You know, it's very labor intensive, but it's not sustainable. And two, the government's not going to help us do anything because they have no money. And three, the government actually tells us knock it off because this water belongs in Egypt. And I said, what do you mean it belongs in Egypt? And he tells me some, but then as I ask other people in Ethiopia, through years of international water treaties, the water of the Blue Nile and the water of the Nile basically belongs to its downstream users, not belongs to them, but they have kind of veto rights on its use, and that's Sudan and Egypt. Sudan and Egypt were both controlled by the British at the time those treaties were set. Ethiopia had the great advantage of never being colonized by a European power. Ethiopia also had the great disadvantage of never being colonized by a European power, because when the European powers came together to sort out what was going on in Africa, Ethiopia wasn't represented. So they said, waters of the Nile belong to Sudan, so the British cotton fields can prosper, and to Egypt, so they can have their breadbasket and the grain warehouses and storehouses of Egypt from the Nile that have gone on since the days of the Pharaoh. You Ethiopians, sorry. Now, it turns out that 80% of the water, 80-85% of the water of the Nile running through Egypt comes from Ethiopia, either from the Blue Nile or other tributaries that go into the Nile. So 80% of the water. This is an Egyptian farmer. He's watering his water buffalo calves. 80% of this water comes from Ethiopia, and is the water that's running, some of the water probably running past Tesfahun's feet. In 2003, the Nile River irrigated 8 million acres of land of the desert in Egypt. In 2003, less than 500,000 acres of land was irrigated in Ethiopia. 8 million irrigated in Egypt, less than 500,000 in Ethiopia, basically all with Ethiopian water, with water that originates in the Ethiopian highlands. The cruel irony, the land that feeds the Nile can't feed itself. So the lesson everybody should learn is that geopolitics is also to blame for today's famine, famines. Quickly, this is an illustration of Something else I raised, these are cotton farmers in Mali, wearing very simple clothes, rags in essence, little sandals on their feet, everything going by hand and foot and by oxen. American cotton farmer in the Mississippi Delta. This is Mr. Ken Hood. He was the head of the American Cotton Association, or whatever the proper title is. When Bush signed the 2002 Farm Bill, the first person he turned around and shook hands with afterwards was Ken Hood. The cotton farmers in America got the largest increase in subsidies in the 2002 Farm Bill. So when you look at these pictures, you're wondering, hey, which of these two people, which of these two farmers deserve subsidies? Ken Hood gets the subsidies. The Tsangari family in Mali gets no subsidies. All their cotton basically goes on the same international market. Who gets impacted the most by that? So that's the outrage portion of this. I'll quickly show some slides of inspiration. Norman Borlaug in the wheat fields of Mexico in 1940, starting the Green Revolution. Norman Borlaug in 2007, 93 years old, still at it. The world turned on him after the Green Revolution. Not turned on him kind of in a violent or angry sense, drifted away from him. Green Revolution happened, he won a Nobel Peace Prize, problem solved, hunger over, famine in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Asia, Latin America, basically a thing in the past. Famine moved to Africa, by that time people were worried about other things, you know. So here was Norman Borlaug, now he's an old man, a lion winner, today he's 95, in failing health, he's still at it, exhorting his disciples to go on. One of his disciples, Howard Buffett, son of Warren. I don't think you'll find Warren in a cornfield. Howard you'll find in a cornfield. Warren also wouldn't have a scrape on his arm or a cheetah bite on his other hand. Howard does. Howard's a farmer in Illinois. He's a philanthropist and an environmentalist. He was in Ghana. He's also a great photographer. In an emergency feeding center in Ghana, he raises his camera, take a picture of this girl, severe state of malnutrition. She looks into his lens finder. At that moment, Howard, father of five, figures, wow, this is what I need to devote my life to. It's the hunger issue. So Howard becomes much more involved in hunger. This girl died a couple of days later, I think. So Howard's out in the fields, helping African farmers on no-till agriculture, on other things that they can do to environmentally helpful to use their farms. Eleni Gabramadon, quickly, Ethiopian economist, cried in the wilderness for years. Markets matter. Markets are important. We need markets at the same time we boost production in Ethiopia. The response was, by the government, by the international development experts, markets are a second-generation problem. Let's deal with the production first. Production came, as we saw, in 2002. The markets weren't there. Markets failed before the weather did. Market failure led to famine. That gave much credence to what Eleni had been crying in the wilderness. She wanted to establish an Ethiopian commodity exchange so that Ethiopian farmers could have the same risk, the same spreading of risk through futures markets, for futures contracts, through storage capacity, through better grading standards, through the advances that the American farmers have through the Chicago Board of Trade. Finally, in April of 2008, Eleni rings the opening bell for the Ethiopian Commodity Exchange. That day was precisely 160 years and one day from the opening of the Chicago Board of Trade. American farmers have enjoyed the benefits of the Chicago Board of Trade for 160 years longer than the Ethiopian farmers have. The Ethiopian farmers, by the way, when the conditions are right, they are the leading producer of cereal and grain in Africa and their rivals to South Africa. So, the inspirational part. You know, some will say the problem of hunger is overwhelming. What can one person do? Well, these folks show what one person can do, and that the size of the problem is matched by the size of the opportunity. So boosting agriculture production, changing our policies to give African farmers a better chance, ending hunger. Yes, it's all in our global security interest. We need more food. We need fewer poor, hungry nations. It's the smart thing to do. But it's not only the smart thing to do, it's the right thing to do. And again, remember what Vody Karrueche told me on my first day in Ethiopia? Look into the eyes of the hungry. Look into their eyes. And you see that nobody should have to die of hunger. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Now it's time for us to take some questions from the audience. So I'll begin. First one, I thought, good question here. Is there a precise definition for hunger?
Yeah, there isn't. I think it's in the notes, the end notes of our book to the first chapter, where we're trying to deal with that question. It would be, if say let's use the USDA requirements for us. I think it's 2,400 calories a day. The FAO for Africa, for some reason, they figure the Africans can get by at 1,800 calories a day. Their numbers are 1,800. I think the USDA is 2,400. We kind of explained that if I don't have the numbers right there. Scott's our numbers guy. So we try to have that explanation there. So it's basically lack of caloric intake.
Good. Wouldn't it be easier and cheaper to feed the world if we limited or stopped population growth by subsidizing family planning?
I don't know what the rumbling in the crowd is supposed to mean. Yeah, it would help. I mean, I guess the thing is that what Norman Borlaug tried to do, and his great accomplishment in the Green Revolution, he wanted to get ahead of the population curve. And he succeeded. And now, as we see by the prevalence numbers, we're back behind it again. I don't think it's a matter of spending money on population control, because what they found and folks who have been researching particularly this question for a long time is that the wealthier families are and the more prosperous they become, the more educated particularly the women are, the less children they have in the family. The more food they're able to grow, the more prosperous they are, hopefully with their food. And if you have the markets right and the market incentives right and the infrastructure right and things like Eleni did with the Ethiopian Commodity Exchange, their surplus crops they can actually take and earn extra money from. These farmers that we saw in Ethiopia, they're the classic $1 a day people in the world. So when you hear about the bottom billion, the people living on a dollar a day, you know, that's these guys. And it's through, you know, Tesfaye, last time I saw him, I was there with some folks from the World Food Program and they were doing some of the translating. And all of a sudden somebody from the World Food Program says, it's very interesting. Tesfaye says his wife is beginning to take some medicine. I said, gee, what's wrong? Is she sick? And he said, well, that's what I asked. He said, no, she's not sick. She's taken it, and he said, I believe the purpose is that we don't have any more children. And I said, well, what does he think about that? And the World Food Program guy asked him, and Tesfaye said, you know, I guess it's something I wish I had heard about a couple of years before, because he had, I think, four children by his first marriage. His first wife died, and I think Hargeisa was the oldest child of his second marriage, so he has a couple of other children here. But even he realizes that, yeah, through the famine, through the hunger problems that they've had, it is a problem with the number of mouths that he has to feed. But again, for these guys, that Hargeisa is his Social Security. They have no Social Security program. They're getting they get no subsidies to help farm. They get there's no safety net program for these people. And so it's the number of children is who's going to take care of them when they're old. Who's going to farm when they can't farm anymore? And so that's why. And they know there is a certain percentage that die. I mean that happens, and that's the reality of their lives. And so that kind of drives that. But again, the longer women stay in school, I guess the findings show the fewer children they'll have. And that would certainly then be one of the solutions.
Okay, good. What are your views of the UN Millennium Development Goals Initiative, which more or less more or less gives more local control to the development, to development planning or planners. Is this initiative promising?
Yeah, I'd say it's promising that it focuses attention on these issues, kind of gets everybody pushing and pulling or whatever to move them in one direction. The first Millennium Development Goal is reduction of poverty and cutting the number of hungry in half. We ain't going to reach that. In fact, the numbers are going the opposite direction, so kind of have failed till this stage miserably. The goal is 2015, so that leaves us with 6 years to do something miraculous to have a sharp decline in the amount of hungry. If through this focus on this, and it's not only by kind of the folks in the rich world who have made these pledges, but it's everybody, including the African governments and the governments of other developing countries, if it focuses everybody's attention on the need to end hunger and increase production, and also for people in the United States and Western Europe, is that the best way to do that is above all to listen to their partners in the developing world and listen to the farmers of Africa, and how best can we help you? What can we do? They will hear on all his trips, on the couple of trips that he made to Africa and all the African visitors that President Bush entertained, he was told repeatedly the damaging nature of subsidies. Obama is hearing that. Hillary Clinton is hearing that. We're not calling for an end to subsidies in the United States, but a new formula for apportionment. If the American people and taxpayers want to pay these subsidies of this money to the American farmer, that's fine. But there's other ways to do it that is not production linked, that causes these gluts that then depress prices on global markets. At the same time, if subsidies have been historically important for us in the U.S., in Western Europe, in Canada, and every place else where there's been an agriculture transformation, why aren't they important for the development of farmers in Africa? Smart subsidies. Not, we don't want kind of open-ended stuff that the subsidies will go on for 50 years like we've had them or something. So if the development, the Millennium Development Goals can really focus attention on this, as I think they have, that's a good thing.
Okay. Somewhat related, because it has to do with international policy or outside policy affecting Africa. Some rich countries are buying huge tracts of African farmland, South Korea and Madagascar, the Chinese I know are in the market for farmland. Do you think this could be positive for the development of African farming techniques and capabilities, or could it be harmful?
And some of the Middle Eastern countries too, primarily the countries, China and India are said to be big in this, or beginning to become more interested in buying these larger tracts of land in Africa, and say countries like the Saudi Arabia, because they need land. Their water resources have been heavily tapped by their increase in production. Their land is you know, whatever is for agriculture is they've reached the limits of that to a certain extent. So they're looking elsewhere. If they're using the African land to grow food for themselves and not for the Africans, then there's a problem with that, and I think the African governments are really aware of this. I was at a meeting of African finance and economic development ministers, and one of them, Trevor Manuel from South Africa, when he was finance minister still, stood up, and he says, we've got to be very wary of this. It's a good thing for the foreign investment to come in and help us with our agricultural practices, but we've got to be careful of a new colonization of our agriculture. Colonial exploitation has been, say, in minerals, in mining, in the extractive industry. Well, agriculture is an extractive industry in a sense, too, that basically nobody's paid attention to in Africa. And now as they do, that there has to be something that's worked out that's also for Africa's benefit and primarily for the peasant farmer. So buying up huge tracts of land that's going to displace a lot of the peasant farmers, that doesn't do anybody any good either, particularly the peasant farmers. That's all they have.
So this gets into a series of questions that people are asking about contradictory agendas. American corporations or European corporations are trying to sell technologies, whether genetically modified organisms or other technology, farming technologies, and then the need of African countries to become more independent, self-sustaining. Could you comment on that potential for contradictions among different actors, and then possibly fold into that the idea of what's the role of the African Union and other internal political bodies in dealing with those contradictions?
Yeah, those are all good questions. Mike, if you can keep me sorted out on them so that I address these. The GM, the biotech. South Africa is the only country in sub-Saharan Africa that uses genetically modified seeds. They're extremely modern. Their agriculture sector is very modern. Kind of the economy, they also have very poor peasant farmers in South Africa, but the larger farmers are extremely well mechanized and very modern. And they have their own seed agricultural research institutions and everything else there, and so they've developed some stuff and then also are using the seeds that are developed here. The rest of Africa doesn't. And I guess what we say in the book, and would be the best thing, is that the African governments are allowed to decide this for themselves. What's happened so far in the rest of Africa is that this dispute over the GM crops between the United States and Europe has basically been waged in Africa. The Africans have a saying, very colorful, when elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled. Africa's the grass in kind of the GM debate. And so there are some African governments that I talked to that have said the Europeans, I think particularly the Scandinavians, but kind of maybe the EU as a whole, and then some of the Scandinavian countries aren't part of the EU, have almost threatened them that if you use genetically modified seeds, we're going to cut off all food exports, because we're not going to be able, you're then uncertain of, well, is this GM food or not? Is there some kind of pollination going on or crossbreeding? And so the Africans themselves ought to decide whether they want to use this or not. If they do, then it ought to be stringently regulated. They need to have all the food safety mechanisms that are there. And the GM ought to be used and primarily intended for the benefit, again, of the peasant farmers. If it's like drought-resistant crops that'll help them, that may be something they want to think about, as opposed to something that makes the corn yellower or, you know, makes you know, the ear bigger or something. If it can grow in drought conditions, you know, whereas otherwise it would die, you know, that would be great. Something that, you know, reduces the use of herbicide spraying. Because when the Africans spray herbicide, it's a backpack on their back, and they're usually the backpack over one shoulder and maybe one of their kids on the other shoulder, and they're spraying and the other kids are walking along. That's not healthy for anybody. And so it's so on the GM front, you know, our position is let the Africans decide for themselves. They're fully capable of deciding these issues. And
so what's the role? What would be the role of the African Union or other African political organizations in this debate or others?
Yeah, exactly. So they could help guide this debate. They could come up with a regulatory framework. There's something called CADAP, which is kind of the Comprehensive African Agriculture Development Policy or something like that. The Obama administration and its plans for this Global Food Security Initiative, they're doing a lot of consultation with this CADAP organization. They really want African input in here. Well, if we get this money from Congress and from our partners around the world, what should we do with it in terms of helping agriculture development? So that's where the consultation with the African Union, with these other, you know, kind of African development and economic organizations, to fully bring them in with it and the planning. Because what you need and what's vital is that, it's not just an increase in development spending and an agriculture development spending of the Western world and the donors to Africa, but that the Africans themselves also increase their spending. So I think in 2004, the Africans pledged to spend 10% of their budgets on agriculture. A handful have reached that, some are on their way. You know, a number of others just, you know, are ignoring it or don't have the resources to do that. So kind of by everybody working together, again, it's you guys got to come along with this too, because if we're doing it ourselves,
it's not going to help. Do you think that these international or these African, pan-African organizations could be instrumental in the development of commodity markets so that you could distribute crops or surpluses from one country to another?
Yeah, I think, Eleni, who we saw, her ultimate goal would be that it's not just an Ethiopian commodity exchange, but becomes one for the Horn, becomes one for East Africa.
Regional
one. The South Africans have one that's been in operation for a long time that works really well. Other countries have smaller ones, you know, that have kind of had, you know, varieties of success. But the Ethiopia one is kind of a model that a number of people are excited about. And Because the problem in Africa is, and it still exists and it's still in Ethiopia today, you may have surplus production in the south, deficit hunger zones in the north or in the pastoral and desert regions, in the Somali area, and the food's not getting there, either because it takes too long for the traders to get it there. There is no mechanism to sell, right? There is no link between buyers and sellers, which at least a commodity exchange provides. If you could do the same thing, Kenya has a food deficit this year. If the Kenyans could buy on the Ethiopian commodity exchange, that's great for the Ethiopian farmers. The more incentive that the African farmers have to grow as much food as possible, the better. And if that, hopefully that incentive can come primarily through the markets.
Couple questions left. One, several people asked the question about the concept of sustainable agriculture systems. That is, we've learned in the United States that certain industrial farming systems have a lot of unintended consequences having to do with pollution of water, loss of soils, other things. What are your thoughts about what we're teaching them in terms of agricultural development? Because I know you're focused on that and you're interested in more agricultural development. Do you have any advice about what kind of farming techniques should be taught?
Right. The sustainability is crucial, Michael, and you're right that, yeah, it's crucial for something that American farmers are always thinking about, and successful farmers anywhere, that you don't want to kind of introduce systems and techniques that, you know, may last for a couple years. And Norman Borlaug was finding this out when he first went over. Okay, here's what you have to do. You use kind of a thimble full. In terms of divvying up how much fertilizer they should use, they were actually using caps from Coca-Cola bottles. And it was kind of, kind of one cap of fertilizer or nutrient per plant or per seed that you were putting in. So very rudimentary thing, but at least it was a gauge for them to use. Borlaug was kind of, you know, propagating these systems. He had like a little microcredit finance thing going. They kind of had a marketing thing going where somebody in Borlaug's organization would kind of buy the crops and make sure they were marketed in this incentive. And he would technically stay 2 or 3 years in whatever village he went to. Yields went up. Boy, you know, 15 years later, they're still saying prayers every night to the health of Norman Borlaug because he was this great guy who came. And boy, who was this guy who did this for us? A couple years after he was gone, the system starts declining because there is no government system to come in and provide the inputs, the seeds, the fertilizer at reduced cost. There's no banking agency or financial system that's coming in, the microfinance, which is starting to take off in a number of countries across Africa and has in Asia, still is weak. The private sector is weak. So there's no sustainability for that. So what Borlaug was finding a couple of years after he leaves, he'd go back and visit the places, and they were kind of back where they were kind of even before he came. Sort of practices like Howard Buffett is showing, kind of no-till agriculture, where, you know, kind of the foliage is kind of left there to kind of preserve the water that's in the soil. The less disturbing of the soil, the less water is being exposed. Plants that basically can regenerate nutrients into the soil. A big problem that Howard Buffett found was kind of the slash and burn agriculture. That when he was flying over and taking pictures of countries, there'd be fires burning in the horizon and distance all the time. And well, what's that? It's farmers basically cutting down forests to expand their planting, because how are African farmers going to get a greater yield? Plant more land instead of making the harvest on the land that they have greater. And so, you know, slash and burn is non-sustainable because it keeps using up more and more, as we were talking about earlier, that the poor damage the environment as much as the rich do. And particularly the poor farmers, because that's like the only option they have, the only option they see.
Okay. With that, we're out of time. So that concludes our program for this evening. I would like to ask the audience to join me in thanking Roger Thoreau for his excellent talk and discussion. Mr. Thoreau will now be signing copies of his book on stage. Thank you and good night.
Enough. Thank you.
Yeah.
We're reasonably on time.
Yeah, that was good. Well, excellent. Yeah, they said go to 7-Eleven.